This is the NPR News Update for Thursday, April 11th. News on your schedule. I'm Perry Finelli. A spring storm with snow, sleet, ice, and rain is hitting Minnesota, causing travel and other problems. State lawmakers are criticizing Mayo Clinic for comments its CEO made, suggesting the clinic might expand elsewhere if Rochester does not get a $500 million subsidy from the state. And Fairview Health Services is focusing on finding a permanent CEO now that rural healthcare giant Sanford has pulled out of merger talks. An April storm continues to create major headaches for many Minnesotans, especially when it comes to travel. For the latest on the spring storm, check out the Updraft blog and related stories at nprnews.org. Worthington continues to use backup generator power after an ice storm disrupted electricity transmissions into the southwest Minnesota city. Worthington Utilities Manager Scott Haynes says the diesel generators were able to keep up with demand overnight.
We were able to carry the load of the entire town through the night without going through the rolling blackout, but we expect that as load picks up this morning, that we'll have to resume that rolling blackout regimen that we used all day yesterday.
Haynes says that means a typical resident will lose power for about 45 minutes before electricity service resumes for an hour or two. That sequence will be repeated through the day. Hundreds of power lines have reported down in the southwest part of the state. Mayo Clinic researchers have had success treating a group of heart failure patients with a special type of stem cell. The researchers use so-called smart stem cells instructed to behave like heart cells. 45 patients were given the stem cells. Another group of heart failure patients were given standard treatments. The study showed the patients given the stem cells saw more improvements in heart health. Dr. Andre Terzic directs Mayo Center for Regenerative Medicine and led the research.
This principle can apply to other organs, and it will be, for example, fantastic to see cells instructed to be more neuron-like, to maybe go after some of the neurological disorders, or to be more bone-like to help, let's say, in orthopedic surgery and so on.
Terzic says it's the first published study using the special stem cells on humans. He says the next step is to use the treatment on a larger group of heart failure patients. Members of the State House Tax Committee had some sharp words for the Mayo Clinic yesterday. Criticism came after Mayo's CEO suggested the clinic would expand elsewhere if Rochester does not receive a $500 million subsidy from the state. Tom Scheck reports.
The House Tax Committee held a hearing one day after Mayo Clinic CEO John Noseworthy delivered his speech at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. At the press club, he said that other states would be eager for Mayo to expand there if the Minnesota legislature doesn't provide a taxpayer subsidy. This isn't the first time the veiled threat was made, but the timing of it frustrated a few members of the House Tax Committee. DFL Representative John Lesh of St. Paul says he was thoroughly disgusted by the comments.
And I know it's hard to come in here, and you can't say this about your CEO, but I'll say it. That was a dumb thing to say. It was dumb, dumb, dumb. This is not our first rodeo. We've had to weigh these kinds of considerations in the past, and we look at it critically. These are taxpayer dollars.
Lesh says that the tax committee's job is to thoroughly vet each and every request for a subsidy. The Mayo Clinic's Bradley Knarr worked to downplay his boss's comments. He said the clinic is not looking to leave Rochester, but is trying to determine where to expand. Knarr says he's focused on winning support from the Minnesota legislature.
I don't want to think, what if? I cannot threaten this group and say, if this, then that. No, I'm not in that business. I want the Mayo Clinic to grow in Minnesota.
Other members of the committee also criticized Noseworthy's comments, but Republican Representative Greg Davids of Preston said he wasn't troubled at all.
If you read what he said, he's just telling the truth. I mean, he's just calling it the way it is, and I happen to respect that, and I really don't understand what the big deal is there. I think Dr. Noseworthy just called it the way he saw it. He says he wanted to emphasize the Mayo Clinic is not threatening to leave Rochester.
The back and forth over the comments come as the House Tax Committee chair is working with the Mayo Clinic and Rochester officials to revise their plan. The current proposal relies on tapping a portion of future income, sales, and property taxes to pay for roads, bridges, and other amenities in Rochester. DFL House Tax Chair Ann Lincheski of Bloomington doesn't like that plan and suggested Rochester and Olmsted County should kick in more for the $585 million plan. Still, she says Mayo will get something, but the state won't pay for the bulk of it.
I think most members want to support something, but not the proposal as introduced on the House side. So, I think they'd like to see things, right-sized a little bit.
DFL Representative Kim Norton of Rochester suggested that changes to the plan are coming. She said some alternatives include having the city do the borrowing for the improvements, with the state providing a subsidy. She says Lincheski is also outlining local taxes to help pick up some of the tab.
She mentioned the potential extension of the sales tax, extension of tax abatement authority, that could help, as well as, I think she listed, entertainment taxes and food and beverage and lodging, not dictating to the city what they have to do, but keeping the door open for things they could do.
The Minnesota Senate Tax Committee will hold a hearing on the Mayo Clinic's bill on Friday. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
A plan to shore up the state's contribution to the new Viking Stadium made its debut last night at the state capitol. Tim Nelson has more.
The plan would levy a 10% wholesale tax on sports-themed clothing and memorabilia licensed by professional sports leagues. It would also tax luxury stadium and arena boxes, as well as personal seat licenses. The Vikings are hoping to sell personal seat licenses to help pay the team's portion of the stadium cost. Finance experts say the additional taxes could help fill in the gap left by disappointing electronic pull-tab revenues. Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority Chairwoman Michelle Kelm-Helgen told lawmakers it sounded like a good option.
It would, I think, provide a good cushion here for the next year. It makes a lot of sense, and it was part of the agreement last year.
But negotiators had removed the memorabilia tax from the final agreement approved by the legislature. DFL sponsor Ann Lincheski said she hopes to include the backup stadium financing in an overall tax bill. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Minnesota business leaders are pushing back against the tax and spending proposals from Governor Mark Dayton and DFL legislative majorities. Tim Pugmire reports.
A coalition of business groups called United for Jobs is airing a new television ad that criticizes the proposed income tax increase on the wealthiest 2% of Minnesotans. They contend that lawmakers should instead be focused on spending smarter. Charlie Weaver, executive director of the Minnesota Business Partnership, said the coalition is raising questions about the need for increased spending.
Hardworking Minnesota taxpayers cannot afford a 7% increase in spending at a time when the economy is only growing at 2%. It's unsustainable and sets us up for more taxes that people can't afford in the future.
A spokesman for the governor said that corporate special interests have not been paying their fair share of taxes and don't want to. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
This is the NPR News Update, available every day around noon, Minnesota's news on your schedule. President Obama's 2014 budget landed with a thud on Capitol Hill yesterday. That plan includes a provision that reduces future deficits by slowing the rate Social Security benefits grow over time. The proposal is known as Chain CPI, and as Brett Neely reports, Minnesota's congressional delegation had a mixed response to it.
While the word betrayal might be too strong, it's hard to describe how much Obama's proposal has upset many Democrats, including Senator Al Franken.
I'm disappointed that so many of us were saying that we don't believe this is the way to go, that he did this.
Obama's proposal would change how inflation is calculated for future cost of living increases. Because the changes would slow the growth of future Social Security payments, many liberals argue it's a benefit cut. The lobbying to stop Chain CPI is already underway on Capitol Hill. Groups such as the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare are urging their supporters to flood Congress with phone calls in opposition.
To be connected to your member of the House of Representatives, press 1. To be connected to your senators, press 2.
8th District Democrat Rick Nolan says part of the outrage about Chain CPI has to do with the pride Democrats have in creating the modern social safety net of Social Security in the 1930s and Medicare in the 1960s. Nolan says signing on to cuts would betray that legacy.
They've been two of the best things we've ever done in this country to lift people out of poverty and extend their lives.
Obama made the offer in the context of wider negotiations with Republicans to close the federal government's long-term budget gaps. Republican leaders have been calling on the president to accept Chain CPI and cuts to Medicare. But Minneapolis Congressman Keith Ellison, a leader among House liberals, believes it's unlikely Republicans can actually accept any offer that Obama makes.
So I think that he thinks that by signaling to the conservative end of the political spectrum that he's given up something and some folks on his coalition don't like it, that that might induce them to come his way. Well, that has not worked.
Ellison and Nolan are among more than 100 House Democrats who have told Obama they won't vote for any legislation that includes chain CPI. But not every member has been so explicit about ruling it out. In a statement, DFL Senator Amy Klobuchar said she would only consider changes to Social Security if they protect the oldest and poorest retirees and are in the context of a large-scale plan to reduce the deficit that includes tax increases. And tax increases are also part of Obama's budget. As to what that means for whether Republicans could sign on, 3rd District Republican Congressman Eric Paulson is doubtful.
Yeah, I think it is a tough sell.
Paulson says the GOP reluctantly swallowed a tax increase at the beginning of the year and won't support another one. While he hadn't had time to read the budget proposal, Paulson did praise Obama for putting Social Security on the negotiating table.
I'll look at the details in the budget proposal, but I think it's helpful that he's making proposals. Absolutely.
Not all Republicans were so charitable. In a statement, 2nd District Congressman John Klein said Obama had offered no new ideas to fix the country's problems. Still, Rick Nolan argues that Obama's offer is played into Republican hands. Nolan notes that Republicans opposed the creation of both Social Security and Medicare, but that they've generally avoided offering direct cuts to the popular programs. Now, Nolan says the GOP has gotten Obama to endorse a cut. Nolan says it reminds him of what deer in the North Woods do.
You know, the old bucks like to stay back in the woods and send the naive young fawns out into the field to make sure it's safe before they go out. And the Republicans are almost like the old bucks here, you know, telling Obama, go on out there and see how this works, you know.
From the looks of it, liberals and conservatives have declared open season on parts of Obama's budget plan. Brett Neely, Minnesota Public Radio News, Washington.
Minneapolis-based Fairview Health Services says it will focus on finding a permanent CEO now that rural healthcare giant Sanford has pulled out of merger talks. Sanford announced yesterday it felt unwelcome and was cutting off discussions of a potential partnership with Fairview. At the same time, Fairview moved away from a merger with the University of Minnesota. Elizabeth Stawicki explains.
It appears Fairview will go solo, at least for the near future. Fairview, one of Minnesota's largest health systems, had been in talks with both Sanford and the U of M. Sanford runs clinics in 8 states, including Minnesota. But Fairview would have been its first foray into a major metropolitan area. But in the last several days, a potential deal with Sanford appeared wobbly after an onslaught of public criticism. On Sunday, Attorney General Lori Swanson grilled Sanford executives in a public hearing, and on Monday, 2 DFL lawmakers introduced legislation to delay, if not stop, the Sanford deal. Sanford's CEO apparently had had enough. Kelby Krabenhoft wrote in a letter to Fairview and Attorney General Swanson that Sanford would only go, quote, where we are invited. He said Sanford would reengage if Fairview and the university work out their relationship and secure a positive understanding from Swanson. Steve Parenti, who heads health finance at the Carlson School of Management at the University of Minnesota, says the Sanford response signaled it didn't want to go in for a firefight.
They wanted to have this be essentially a communion of equals, and didn't seem like that type of language was sort of forthcoming, and realized it'd be a bigger slog and walked away.
The parties issued a flurry of written statements yesterday. Fairview and Sanford declined interviews, as did Swanson. The Minnesota Attorney General released a statement that said charitable institutions exist because of public support, and the public has a stake in their outcome. Fairview's interim CEO, Chuck Moody, put out a statement that Fairview understood why Sanford chose to step back from the talks, but that it was still disappointed. The University of Minnesota had also been in talks to acquire Fairview. Fairview's statement said it was not the time to discuss any proposal that involves the university acquiring Fairview. In a letter to top U of M leaders, President Eric Kaler called the news disappointing. Linda Cohen, chairwoman of the University Board of Regents, says news of Fairview's decision was a surprise to her, and that the U's acquisition of Fairview could have been good for both sides.
My belief is the same as President Kaler's, that the present situation seems not sustainable, and it's very disappointing news.
She says the U should continue to try to have a closer management relationship with Fairview, as well as work on a planned new ambulatory care center. Cohen says she hopes Fairview just wants to pull back and think, and that talks of an acquisition aren't over forever. The University of Minnesota sold the U of M hospitals to Fairview in 1997 at a time when many universities were spinning off their hospitals to other organizations. That's according to Diane Villacava, an analyst at Moody's, which provides credit ratings in research. The idea that the University of Minnesota might be interested in getting more control over its flagship hospitals would be part of an emerging trend that's been happening in other states.
What we have seen across the country is universities are beginning to look. There are some that have brought the hospitals back into their structure or have restructured themselves to at least have a closer relationship with the university.
Meanwhile, Representative Joe Atkins, a DFLer from Invergrove Heights, who introduced legislation that would have blocked Sanford from ultimately controlling the University of Minnesota hospitals, says he still intends to hold hearings on his bill. He said the issue was never about Sanford, but any out-of-state entity that could take control of the University of Minnesota Medical Center. With reporting from Alex Friedrich, Elizabeth Stawicki, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The state may soon give new life to a small program that helps poor Minnesotans buy homes, start businesses, or fund an education. The program has unusually high success rates for moving people out of poverty, but lawmakers cut its state funding 2 years ago, and the program was drastically scaled back, Rupa Shenoy reports.
10 years ago, Rena Moran and her seven children were homeless for several months. She was 43 and unemployed. Today, the family owns a three-bedroom home in St. Paul's Rondo neighborhood, and Moran works as a representative in the state legislature.
And I'm truly one to believe that no one does it by themselves unless they're just really privileged and been. And then again, they haven't done it by themselves neither.
Moran had help from a program called Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota. It's known as FAME, and it operates on the principle that to move out of poverty, people need to build assets. FAME participants get one-on-one help from a financial counselor. They need that help because they're going to start building up savings. They get a 3-to-1 savings match. So every month, they have to set aside $40 and put it in a savings account. And if they do that, they get $120 added to the savings account from the program. Moran says she took $40 a month from the family's food and clothing budget without telling her kids.
And you want to say, how can I put away $40? I just can't do it. But I don't know. I did it.
Like other participants in the program, Moran could only use the money to pay for one of three things, an education, to start a business, or to buy a home. And 2 years after entering the program, Moran had enough savings to buy and maintain a house.
To know that I had money in the bank. Money there that I had saved to allow this moment to happen is awesome.
In that very short period of time, she was able to purchase a home, and she has moved on to become a policymaker at the state legislature. Now, did FAME do that all for her? Absolutely not. But were we a part of it? Yes.
FAME's statewide coordinator, Kate Overson, says the majority of participants are successful. In its 12 years, FAME says it's helped nearly 1,800 people save a total of $2.5 million. The program surveyed participants last year and found that almost all were still in their homes and 85% of businesses were still in operation. Studies done by the U of M and Gustavus Adolphus College found similar results. FAME carefully selects who can participate. To qualify, each applicant must be employed and have a household income less than $47,000 for a family of four. Overson says the results show the state got a lot back for its investment. Every year for 10 years, the state kicked in $250,000. The federal government matched that.
So for $500,000, we are able to show that people are vital participants in their communities.
But 2 years ago, FAME lost its state funding. It found enough money to keep going, but couldn't serve as many people. This year, the program didn't make it into Governor Mark Dayton's first proposed budget. Erin Sullivan Sutton is an assistant human services commissioner in the Dayton administration.
When any governor is looking at putting together a budget where the projected deficit is great, not everything that people would like to see in is able to get in.
That's when DFL Representative Rena Moran stepped in, along with Republican colleagues like Representative Jim Abler of Anoka and Senator Michelle Benson of Ham Lake. She pushed legislation to restore funding for FAME. When those bills were heard in House and Senate committees recently, Republican Senator Mary Kiffmeyer of Big Lake was one of many legislators who praised the program.
I mean, wow. Mm-hmm. You actually get to see the tangibles here. There aren't many that come to us that have this kind of documentation and track record.
Representatives added the $250,000 in annual funding to a budget bill. Governor Dayton has also restored the funding in his supplemental budget. Assistant Human Services Commissioner Sutton says a February budget forecast showed Dayton he had more money to work with, and he chose to fund FAME. Rena Moran says she's glad her colleagues at the Capitol understand that it's important to invest in people.
We need to know and believe that poor people are smart people. When you give them an opportunity, when you invest in them, they make good choices.
FAME's future state funding is a small part of the budget legislators and the governor negotiate over the next several weeks. Rupa Shenoy, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A national report is shedding light on the high suspension rates among students of color and special needs children in Minnesota's largest school district. Laura Ewan has more.
About 9% of St. Paul Public School students were suspended in the 2009-2010 school year, but mirroring a national trend, the suspension rate was significantly higher for African Americans and students with disabilities. Report author Daniel Lowson is director of the Center for Civil Rights Remedies at the University of California, Los Angeles. He says one of the most startling findings pertained to Black boys with disabilities. He says two-thirds of them enrolled in St. Paul middle or high schools were suspended at least once.
Nationally, their rate is 36%, which is horrific. So to be almost double the national average is certainly way out there.
St. Paul District officials note that the data are about 3 years old and say they have since vastly reduced suspension rates for African Americans and kids in special ed. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
10 men have been indicted in federal court for allegedly poaching walleye from the Red Lake and Leech Lake Indian reservations and then selling fish illegally on the black market. Tom Robertson has more.
The charges outlined in four separate indictments date back to July of 2009. The charges claim that some of the men took fish from Red Lake and sold them illegally to a bar owner in Bagley. Other defendants are accused of illegally using nets to catch fish on several lakes on the Leech Lake Reservation. The indictments claim the men then sold the fish for commercial purposes, including sales of fish to a restaurant owner in Bena. The business owners in Bagley and Bena are among those facing indictments. Authorities estimated the market value of the fish in all of the cases to be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. If convicted, each of the men could face a maximum penalty of 5 years in prison. Tom Robertson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Bemidji.
What comes out of your printer? Anything more than paper? Well, these days you can print a wrench, a working clock, or a killer design for a custom motorcycle. Objects designed on a computer can be sent to machines known as 3D printers that will build them layer by tiny layer. Stratasys, an Eden Prairie-based firm, is a leading player in the 3D printing world, helping customers create parts for cars, planes, robots, orthodontics, and much more. Martin Moreland reports.
Stratasys printers don't use ink. They lay down thin layers of molten plastic, slowly building up three-dimensional objects with relentless precision.
The layers can be anywhere from 3/1000ths of an inch up to 10/1000ths of an inch.
John Cobb is the company's executive vice president for global marketing. He says a product designed using CAD, computer-aided design software, can go straight to a 3D printer for production.
You're able to replicate exactly what the designer had in mind because you're going directly from the CAD file right to the actual printed part.
Stratasys machines cost from $10,000 to $600,000. Some are about the size of an office laser printer. Others are as big as a car. They can produce smaller items like prototypes for cell phone cases or soles for athletic shoes in several hours. Larger objects like panels for a car can take a couple of days to produce. Cobb says 3D printing is winning over more and more inventors, designers, even artists.
When we started, people looked at the technology at trade shows and they were, you know, fascinated by what it could do, but maybe they couldn't quite figure out how they were going to use it. Over the last, I'd say, 2 years, the amount of interest in 3D printing has absolutely skyrocketed.
To take advantage of that momentum, last year Stratasys has merged with one of its top competitors, Israel-based Objet. The company's combined revenue soared 30% over their 2011 results. For products ranging from medical devices to snowmobiles, 3D printing permits manufacturing firms to make prototypes faster and cheaper than traditional methods. That allows companies to decide sooner if an item should be mass-produced or not. Orange County Choppers, the inspiration for the Discovery Channel's American Chopper series, owns a Stratasys 3D printer, which it uses to make custom parts for motorcycles. No one from the New York shop responded to interview requests, but a promotional video shows designer Jason Pohl telling how the shop made a bike in the shape of a dragon with a fearsomely fanged head thrust out over the front wheel.
This dragon is angry. It has power, and it has character. And how do we make that? When it all came down, there was only one option, and that was to print the head out.
Investors also have become very enthusiastic about Stratasys. The firm's stock is up nearly 60% over the past 2 years. Daugherty & Company analyst Andrea James says the company's success will likely continue.
They're going to grow 22%, 25% year over year, especially as new uses for 3D printed objects are invented.
Wohlers Associates, a Colorado consulting firm, reports Stratasys and Objet accounted for about 56% of all industrial-grade 3D printer systems sold worldwide in 2011. Industry consultant Terry Wohlers says demand for 3D printers is likely to be greatest in the manufacturing sector, supplying companies that need components in limited quantities.
Making parts that go into final products for planes, medical devices, dental products, and then a variety of consumer products as well.
One Stratasys customer, for instance, recently made about 100 copies of a part for Delta Airlines MD-80 series jets. The planes, with an average age of about 23 years, needed a part that goes in the aircraft's laboratories. But the part was no longer available, so it was recreated digitally and printed. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And finally, the 2013 Minneapolis-St. Paul International Film Festival launches tonight. By the time it ends on April 28, it will have presented over 200 films, thrown parties, hosted dozens of filmmakers, and held panels on the film business. Ewan Kerr takes a look at some of the highlights of this year's festival.
The question always with a festival like this is, where to start? How about with the opening scene of the opening movie?
This is an unusual case, my lord. The accused was at an unmanned station under the influence of a strong, fortified wine.
As director Ken Loach's latest film, The Angel's Share, opens, Albert, a none-too-bright and very drunk Scotsman, starts hearing voices. He doesn't realize railway staff miles away are watching him over closed-circuit cameras. They warn him a train is coming.
Stand back. What would you do with your totem? Stand back.
Stand back!
That's right, you heard me. Stand back!
If you say so, pal.
And with that, he falls off the platform onto the line. He escapes with his life, but is launched onto an adventure and a heist involving very rare single malt Scotch whiskey. Ken Loach has been making socially aware films in the UK for half a century. Minneapolis-St. Paul International Film Festival Executive Director Susan Smolhalski says his latest film seemed like a great opener.
As anyone who knows Ken Loach will know, they're wildly intelligent and political films, but they're also really funny.
After The Angel's Share, it's off to the cinematic races. There are films from all over the world. Features, documentaries, animation, and even what the organizers call the childish screenings on Saturday mornings for younger film fans. There are local premieres of big-name movies, including Deepa Mehta's adaptation of Salman Rushdie's debut novel Midnight's Children and a modern-day adaptation of the Henry James classic satirical novel What Maisie Knew, about bad parents and the people who cover for them. Smolhalski is particularly excited by a series called Songs of Exile, Cinema of Movement. She says it includes 20 dramas and documentaries.
Dealing with the topic of the movement of people and peoples.
There are stories ranging from migration of refugees from war-torn African countries to how decommissioned U.S. school buses make their way to Guatemala to become part of that country's dangerous mass transit system. Another important series for the festival is Minnesota Made, a selection of local features, documentaries, and shorts. Curator Craig Rice has had the huge task of winnowing down the entries. He says he was struck at the quality of the work, particularly the documentaries.
There's several films right now that I think, you know, could possibly even be Academy Award nominated type films.
Rice singles out Too Cold Out There Without You, a documentary about an Episcopal minister from rural Minnesota undergoing female-to-male gender reassignment. His list goes on.
There's a wonderful documentary called Twilight on the Mississippi, which is about a group of young people that build the raft and try to sail down to New Orleans. And I won't give away the ending, but nobody actually dies.
Rice is also organizing a series of panels on Sunday afternoons during the festival on screenwriting, on acting, and on film distribution, which is often a movie maker's greatest challenge. With so much on offer at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Film Festival, it's easy to get overwhelmed. When asked for suggestions on how to approach the program, Rice suggests just picking a day and choosing from that. Festival programmer Jesse Bishop suggests looking for movies where the filmmakers will be in attendance.
We've over 100 visiting filmmakers this year, including Minnesota-made filmmakers.
Bishop is particularly excited about the world premiere of a new movie about the Duluth band Low. It's called Low Movie, How to Quit Smoking. Not only will the filmmakers be in attendance at the screening tomorrow night, so will the band, which will perform after. Not surprisingly, the show, as with the opening night screenings, are already sold out. Ewan Kerr, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And that's the NPR News Update for Thursday, April 11th. I'm Perry Finelli. Thanks for listening.